Chapter 12. The Road to Munich. Case Green was the code name of the plan for a surprise attack on Czechoslovakia. It had first been drawn up, as we have seen, on June 24, 1937, by Field Marshal von Blomberg, and Hitler had elaborated on it in his lecture to the generals on November 5, admonishing them that the descent upon the Czechs would have to be carried out with lightning speed, and that it might take place as early as 1938. Obviously, the easy conquest of Austria now made Case Green a matter of some urgency. The plan must be brought up to date, and preparations for carrying it out begun. It was for this purpose that Hitler summoned Keitel on April 21, 1938. On the following day, Major Rudolf Schmundt, the Führer's new military aide, prepared a summary of the discussion, which was divided into three parts: political aspects, military conclusions, and propaganda. Hitler rejected the idea of strategic attack out of the blue without cause or possibility of justification because of hostile world opinion which might lead to a critical situation. He thought a second alternative, action after a period of diplomatic discussions which gradually lead to a crisis and to war, was undesirable because Green security measures will have been taken. The Führer preferred, at the moment at least, a third alternative. Lightning action based on an incident, for example, the murder of the German minister in the course of an anti-German demonstration. Such an incident, it will be remembered, was at one time planned to justify a German invasion of Austria, when Papen was to have been the victim. In Hitler's gangster world, German envoys abroad were certainly expendable. The German warlord, as he now was, since he had taken over personal command of the armed forces, emphasized to General Keitel the necessity of speed in the operations. The first 4 days of military action are, politically speaking, decisive. In the absence of outstanding military successes, a European crisis is certain to rise. Fait accompli must convince foreign powers of the hopelessness of military intervention. As for the propaganda side of the war, it was not yet time to call in Dr. Goebbels. Hitler merely discussed leaflets for the conduct of the Germans in Czechoslovakia, and those which would contain threats to intimidate the Czechs. The Republic of Czechoslovakia, which Hitler was now determined to destroy, was the creation of the peace treaties, so hateful to the Germans, after the First World War. It was also the handiwork of two remarkable Czech intellectuals, Tomáš Garrigue Masaryk, a self-educated son of a coachman, who became a noted savant and the country's first president, and Eduard Beneš, son of a peasant, who worked his way through the University of Prague and three French institutions of higher learning, and who, after serving almost continually as foreign minister, became the second president on the retirement of Masaryk in 1935. Carved out of the Habsburg Empire, which in the 16th century had acquired the ancient kingdom of Bohemia, Czechoslovakia developed during the years that followed its founding in 1918 into the most democratic, progressive, enlightened, and prosperous state in Central Europe. But by its very makeup of several different nationalities, it was gripped from the beginning by a domestic problem which over 20 years it had not been able entirely to solve. This was the question of its minorities. Within the country lived 1 million Hungarians, 500,000 Ruthenians, and 3.25 million Sudeten Germans. These peoples looked longingly toward their mother countries, Hungary, Russia, and Germany, respectively, though the Sudeteners had never belonged to the German Reich, except as a part of the loosely formed Holy Roman Empire, but only to Austria. At the least, these minorities desired more autonomy than they had been given. Even the Slovaks, who formed a quarter of the 10 million Czechoslovaks, wanted some measure of autonomy. Although racially and linguistically closely related to the Czechs, the Slovaks had developed differently, historically, culturally, and economically, largely due to their centuries-old domination by Hungary. An agreement between Czech and Slovak émigrés in America, signed in Pittsburgh on May 30, 1918, had provided for the Slovaks having their own government, parliament, and courts, but the government in Prague had not felt bound by this agreement and had not kept it. To be sure, compared to minorities in most other countries, even in the West, even in America, those in Czechoslovakia were not badly off. They enjoyed not only full democratic and civil rights, including the right to vote, but to a certain extent were given their own schools and allowed to maintain their own cultural institutions. Leaders of the minority political parties often served as ministers in the central government. Nevertheless, the Czechs, not fully recovered from the effects of centuries of oppression by the Austrians, left a great deal to be desired in solving the minorities' problem. They were often chauvinistic and frequently tactless. I recall from my own earlier visits to the country the deep resentment in Slovakia against the imprisonment of Dr. Wojciech Tuka, at that time a respected professor, who had been sentenced to 15 years confinement for treason, though it was doubtful that he was guilty of more than working for Slovak autonomy. Above all, the minority groups felt that the Czechoslovak government had not honored the promises made by Masaryk and Beneš to the Paris Peace Conference in 1919 to establish a cantonal system similar to that of Switzerland. Ironically enough, in view of what is now to be set down here, the Sudeten Germans had fared tolerably well in the Czechoslovak state, certainly better than any other minority in the country, and better than the German minorities in Poland or in fascist Italy. They resented the petty tyrannies of local Czech officials and the discrimination against them that sometimes occurred in Prague. They found it difficult to adjust to the loss of their former dominance in Bohemia and Moravia under the Habsburgs. But lying in compact groups along the northwestern and southwestern parts of the new republic, where most of the industry of the country was concentrated, they prospered, and as the years went by, they gradually reached a state of relative harmony with the Czechs, continuing always to press for more autonomy and more respect for their linguistic and cultural rights. Until the rise of Hitler, there was no serious political movement which asked for more. The Social Democrats and other democratic parties received most of the Sudeten votes. Then in 1933, when Hitler became chancellor, the virus of National Socialism struck the Sudeten Germans. In that year was formed the Sudeten German Party, SDP, under the leadership of a mild-mannered gymnastics teacher by the name of Konrad Henlein. By 1935, the party was being secretly subsidized by the German Foreign Office to the amount of 15,000 marks a month. Within a couple of years, it had captured the majority of the Sudeten Germans, only the Social Democrats and the Communists remaining outside it. By the time of the Anschluss, Henlein's party, which for 3 years had been taking its orders from Berlin, was ready to do the bidding of Adolf Hitler. To receive this bidding, Henlein sped to Berlin a fortnight after the annexation of Austria, and on March 28th was closeted with Hitler for 3 hours, Ribbentrop and Hess also being present. Hitler's instructions, as revealed in a Foreign Office memorandum, were that demands should be made by the Sudeten German Party which are unacceptable to the Czech government. As Henlein himself summarized the Führer's views, "We must always demand so much that we can never be satisfied." Thus, the plight of the German minority in Czechoslovakia was for Hitler merely a pretext, as Danzig was to be a year later in regard to Poland, for cooking up a stew in a land he coveted, undermining it, confusing and misleading its friends, and concealing his real purpose. What that purpose was he had made clear in his November 5th harangue to the military leaders and in the initial directives of Case Green: to destroy the Czechoslovak state and to grab its territories and inhabitants for the Third Reich. Despite what had happened in Austria, the leaders of France and Great Britain did not grasp this. All through the spring and summer, indeed almost to the end, Prime Minister Chamberlain and Premier Daladier apparently sincerely believed, along with most of the rest of the world, that all Hitler wanted was justice for his kinsfolk in Czechoslovakia. In fact, as the spring days grew warmer, the British and French governments went out of their way to pressure the Czech government to grant far-reaching concessions to the Sudeten Germans. On May 3rd, the new German ambassador in London, Herbert von Dirksen, was reporting to Berlin that Lord Halifax had informed him of a démarche the British government would shortly make in Prague, which would aim at inducing Beneš to show the utmost measure of accommodation to the Sudeten Germans. 4 days later, on May 7th, the British and French ministers in Prague made their démarche, urging the Czech government to go to the utmost limit, as the German minister reported to Berlin, to meet the Sudeten demands. Hitler and Ribbentrop seemed quite pleased to find that the British and French governments were so concerned with aiding them. Concealment of German aims, however, was more than ever necessary at this stage. On May 12th, Henlein paid a secret visit to the Wilhelmstrasse in Berlin and received instructions from Ribbentrop on how to bamboozle the British when he arrived in London that evening to see Sir Robert Van Sittart, chief diplomatic adviser to the Foreign Secretary, and other British officials. A memorandum by Weizsäcker laid down the line to be taken. Henlein will deny in London that he is acting on instructions from Berlin. Finally, Henlein will speak of the progressive disintegration of the Czech political structure in order to discourage those circles which consider that their intervention on behalf of this structure may still be of use. On the same day, the German minister in Prague was wiring Ribbentrop about the need of precaution to cover his legation in its work of handing over money and instructions to the Sudeten German Party. Hugh R. Wilson, the American ambassador in Berlin, called on Weizsäcker on May 14th to discuss the Sudeten crisis and was told of German fears that Czech authorities were deliberately provoking a European crisis in order to try to prevent the disintegration of Czechoslovakia. 2 days later, on May 16th, Major Schmundt got off an urgent and most secret telegram to OKW headquarters on behalf of Hitler, who was resting at Obersalzberg, asking how many divisions on the Czech frontier were ready to march within 12 hours in the case of mobilization. Lieutenant Colonel Zeitzler of the OKW staff replied immediately, 12. This did not satisfy Hitler. "Please send the numbers of the divisions," he asked. And the answer came back, listing 10 infantry divisions by their numbers and adding one armored and one mountain division. Hitler was getting restless for action. The next day, the 17th, he was inquiring of OKW for precise information on the fortifications which the Czechs had constructed in the Sudeten Mountains on their borders. These were known as the Czech Maginot Line. Zeitzler replied from Berlin on the same day with a long and most secret telegram, informing the Führer in considerable detail of the Czech defense works. He made it clear that they were fairly formidable. The First Crisis, May 1938. The weekend which began on Friday, May 20th, developed into a critical one and would later be remembered as the May Crisis. During the ensuing 48 hours, the governments in London, Paris, Prague, and Moscow were panicked into the belief that Europe stood nearer to war than it had at any time since the summer of 1914. This may have been largely due to the possibility that new plans for a German attack on Czechoslovakia, which were drawn up for Hitler by OKW and presented to him on that Friday, leaked out. At any rate, it was believed, at least in Prague and London, that Hitler was about to launch aggression against Czechoslovakia. In this belief, the Czechs began to mobilize, and Britain, France, and Russia displayed a firmness and a unity in the face of what their governments feared to be an imminent German threat, which they were not to show again until a new world war had almost destroyed them. On Friday, May 20th, General Keitel dispatched to Hitler at the Obersalzberg a new draft of Case Green, which he and his staff had been working on since the Führer had laid down the general lines for it in their meeting on April 21st. In an obsequious letter to the leader attached to the new plan, Keitel explained that it took into account the situation created by the incorporation of Austria into the German Reich, and that it would not be discussed with the commanders-in-chief of the three armed services until you, my Führer, approved it and signed it. The new directive for Green, dated Berlin, May 20, 1938, is an interesting and significant document. It is a model of the kind of Nazi planning for aggression with which the world later became acquainted. "It is not my intention," it began, "to smash Czechoslovakia by military action in the immediate future without provocation, unless an unavoidable development within Czechoslovakia forces the issue, or political events in Europe create a particularly favorable opportunity which may perhaps never recur." Three political possibilities for commencing the operation are considered. The first, a sudden attack without convenient outward excuse, is rejected. Operations preferably will be launched either A. After a period of increasing diplomatic controversies and tension linked with military preparations, which will be exploited so as to shift the war guilt on the enemy, B, by lightning action as the result of a serious incident which will subject Germany to unbearable provocation, and which, in the eyes of at least a part of world opinion, affords the moral justification for military measures. Case B is more favorable, both from a military and a political point of view. As for the military operation itself, it was to attain such a success within 4 days that it would demonstrate to enemy states which may wish to intervene the hopelessness of the Czech military position, and also provide an incentive to those states which have territorial claims upon Czechoslovakia to join in immediately against her. Those states were Hungary and Poland, and the plan counted on their intervention. Whether France would honor its obligations to the Czechs was considered doubtful, but attempts by Russia to give Czechoslovakia military support are to be expected. The German High Command, or at least Keitel and Hitler, were so confident that the French would not fight that only a minimum strength is to be provided as a rear cover in the West. And it was emphasized that the whole weight of all forces must be employed in the invasion of Czechoslovakia. The task of the bulk of the army, aided by the Luftwaffe, was to smash the Czechoslovak army and to occupy Bohemia and Moravia as quickly as possible. It was to be total war, and for the first time in the planning of German soldiers, the value of what the directive calls propaganda warfare and economic warfare is emphasized, and their employment woven into the overall military plan of attack. Propaganda warfare must, on the one hand, intimidate the Czechs by means of threats and wear down their power of resistance. On the other hand, it must give the national minorities indications as to how to support our military operations and influence the neutrals in our favor. Economic warfare has the task of employing all available economic resources to hasten the final collapse of the Czechs. In the course of military operations, it is important to help to increase the total economic war effort by rapidly collecting information about important factories and setting them going again as soon as possible. For this reason, the sparing, as far as military operations permit, of Czech industrial and engineering establishments may be of decisive importance to us. This model for Nazi aggression was to remain essentially unchanged and to be used with staggering success until an aroused world much later woke up to it. Shortly after noon on May 20th, the German minister in Prague sent an urgent and most secret wire to Berlin, reporting that the Czech foreign minister had just informed him by telephone that his government was perturbed by reports of concentration of German troops in Saxony. He had replied, he said, that there were absolutely no grounds for anxiety, but he requested Berlin to inform him immediately what, if anything, was up. This was the first of a series of feverish diplomatic exchanges that weekend, which shook Europe with the fear that Hitler was about to move again, and that this time a general war would follow. The basis for the information received by British and Czech intelligence that German troops were concentrating on the Czech border has never, so far as I know, come to light. To a Europe still under the shock of the German military occupation of Austria, there were several straws in the wind. On May 19th, a newspaper in Leipzig had published a report of German troop movements. Henlein, the Sudetenführer, had announced the breaking off of his party's negotiations with the Czech government on May 9th, and it was known that on his return from London on the 14th he had stopped off at Berchtesgaden to see Hitler and that he was still there. There were shooting affrays in the Sudetenland. And all through May, Dr. Goebbels's propaganda war, featuring wild stories of Czech terror against the Sudeten Germans, had been stepped up. The tension seemed to be reaching a climax. Though there was some movement of German troops in connection with spring maneuvers, particularly in the eastern regions, no evidence was ever found from the captured German documents indicating any sudden new concentration of armed forces on the Czech border at this moment. On the contrary, two German Foreign Office papers dated May 21st contained confidential assurances to the Wilhelmstrasse from Colonel Jodl of the OKW that there had been no such concentrations either in Silesia or in Lower Austria. There had been nothing, Jodl asserted in messages not intended for foreign perusal, apart from peacetime maneuvers. It was not that the Czech border was denuded of German troops. As we have seen, on May 16th, Hitler had been informed by OKW, in answer to his urgent request for information, that there were 12 German divisions on the Czech frontier, ready to march within 12 hours. Could it have been that Czech or British intelligence got wind of the telegrams which exchanged this information, and that they learned of the new directive for Green which Keitel dispatched for Hitler's approval on May 20th? For on the next day, the Czech Chief of Staff, General Krejci, told the German military attaché in Prague, Colonel Toussaint, that he had irrefutable proof that in Saxony a concentration of from 8 to 10 German divisions had taken place. The figures on the number of divisions were not far from correct, even if the information on the manner of their deployment was somewhat inaccurate. At any rate, on the afternoon of May 20th, following an emergency cabinet session at Radchin Palace in Prague, presided over by President Beneš, the Czechs decided on an immediate partial mobilization. One class was called to the colors, and certain technical reservists were mobilized. The Czech government, in contrast to the Austrian 2 months before, did not intend to give up without a fight. The Czech mobilization, partial though it was, sent Adolf Hitler into a fit of fury, and his feelings were not assuaged by the dispatches that arrived for him at Obersalzberg from the German Foreign Office in Berlin, telling of continual calls by the British and French ambassadors, warning Germany that aggression against Czechoslovakia meant a European war. The Germans had never been subjected to such strenuous and persistent diplomatic pressure as the British employed on this weekend. Sir Neville Henderson, the British ambassador, who had been sent to Berlin by Prime Minister Chamberlain to apply his skills as a professional diplomat to the appeasement of Hitler, and who applied them to the utmost, called repeatedly at the German Foreign Office to inquire about German troop movements and to advise caution. There is no doubt that he was egged on by Lord Halifax and the British Foreign Office. For Henderson, a suave, debonair diplomat, had little sympathy with the Czechs, as all who knew him in Berlin were aware. He saw Ribbentrop twice on May 21st, and on the next day, though it was a Sunday, called on State Secretary von Weizsäcker, Ribbentrop having been hastily convoked to Hitler's presence at Obersalzberg, to deliver a personal message from Halifax stressing the gravity of the situation. In London, the British Foreign Secretary also called in the German ambassador on the Sabbath and emphasized how grave the moment was. In all these British communications, the Germans did not fail to note, as Ambassador von Dirksen pointed out in a dispatch after seeing Halifax, that the British government, while certain that France would go to the aid of Czechoslovakia, did not affirm that Britain would too. The furthest the British would go was to warn, as Dirksen says Halifax did, that in the event of a European conflict it was impossible to foresee whether Britain would not be drawn into it. As a matter of fact, this was as far as Chamberlain's government would ever go, until it was too late to stop Hitler. It was this writer's impression in Berlin from that moment until the end, that had Chamberlain frankly told Hitler that Britain would do what it ultimately did in the face of Nazi aggression, the Führer would never have embarked on the adventures which brought on the Second World War, an impression which has been immensely strengthened by the study of the secret German documents. This was the well-meaning Prime Minister's fatal mistake. Adolf Hitler, brooding fitfully in his mountain retreat above Berchtesgaden, felt deeply humiliated by the Czechs and by the support given them in London, Paris, and even Moscow. And nothing could have put the German dictator in a blacker, uglier mood. His fury was all the more intense because he was accused prematurely of being on the point of committing an aggression which he indeed intended to commit. That very weekend he had gone over the new plan for Green submitted by Keitel. But it could not be carried out at once. Swallowing his pride, he ordered the Foreign Office in Berlin to inform the Czech envoy on Monday, May 23rd, that Germany had no aggressive intentions toward Czechoslovakia, and that the reports of German troop concentrations on her borders were without foundation. In Prague, London, Paris, and Moscow, the government leaders breathed a sigh of relief. The crisis had been mastered. Hitler had been given a lesson. He must now know he could not get away with aggression as easily as he had done in Austria. Little did these statesmen know the Nazi dictator. After sulking at Obersalzberg a few more days, during which there grew within him a burning rage to get even with Czechoslovakia, and particularly with President Beneš, who he believed had deliberately humiliated him, he suddenly appeared in Berlin on May 28th and convoked the ranking officers of the Wehrmacht to the Chancellery to hear a momentous decision. He himself told of it in a speech to the Reichstag 8 months later. "I resolved to solve once and for all, and this radically, the Sudeten question. On May 28th, I ordered, 1. That preparations should be made for military action against this state by October 2nd, 2. That the construction of our western defenses should be greatly extended and speeded up. The immediate mobilization of 96 divisions was planned, to begin with." To his assembled Confederates, Göring, Keitel, Brauchitsch, Beck, Admiral Raeder, Ribbentrop, and Neurath, he thundered, "It is my unshakable will that Czechoslovakia shall be wiped off the map." Case Green was again brought out and again revised. Jodl's diary traces what had been going on in Hitler's feverish, vindictive mind. "The intention of the Führer not to activate the Czech problem as yet is changed because of the Czech strategic troop concentration of May 21st, which occurs without any German threat and without the slightest cause for it. Because of Germany's self-restraint, its consequences lead to a loss of prestige of the Führer, which he is not willing to take again. Therefore, the new directive for Green is issued on May 30th. The details of the new directive on Case Green, which Hitler signed on May 30th, do not differ essentially from those of the version submitted to Hitler 9 days before. But there are two significant changes. Instead of the opening sentence of May 21st, which read, "It is not my intention to smash Czechoslovakia in the near future," the new directive began, "It is my unalterable decision to smash Czechoslovakia by military action in the near future." What the near future meant was explained by Keitel in a covering letter. "Green's execution," he ordered, "must be assured by October 1, 1938 at the latest." It was a date which Hitler would adhere to through thick and thin, through crisis after crisis, and at the brink of war, without flinching. Wavering of the Generals. After noting in his diary on May 30th that Hitler had signed the new directive for Green, and that because of its demand for an immediate breakthrough into Czechoslovakia right on X day, the previous intentions of the army must be changed considerably, Jodl added the following sentence. The whole contrast becomes acute once more between the Führer's intuition that we must do it this year and the opinion of the army that we cannot do it as yet because most certainly the Western powers will interfere and we are not as yet equal to them. The perceptive Wehrmacht staff officer had put his finger on a new rift between Hitler and some of the highest-ranking generals of the army. The opposition to the Führer's grandiose plans for aggression was led by General Ludwig Beck, chief of the Army General Staff, who henceforth would assume the leadership of such resistance as there was to Hitler in the Third Reich. Later, this sensitive, intelligent, decent, but indecisive general would base his struggle against the Nazi dictator on broad grounds. As late as the spring of 1938, however, after more than 4 years of National Socialism, Beck opposed the Führer only on the narrower professional grounds that Germany was not yet strong enough to take on the Western powers, and perhaps Russia as well. Beck, as we have seen, had welcomed Hitler's coming to power and had publicly acclaimed the Führer for re-establishing the conscript German army in defiance of Versailles. As far back as 1930, it will be remembered from earlier pages, Beck, then an obscure regimental commander, had gone out of his way to defend three of his subalterns on a treason charge that they were fomenting Nazism in the armed forces, and, in fact, had testified in their favor before the Supreme Court after Hitler had appeared on the stand and warned that when he came to power, heads would roll. It was not the Führer's aggression against Austria, which Beck had supported, but the rolling of General von Fritsch's head after the Gestapo frame-up, which seems to have cleared his mind. Swept of its cobwebs, it began to perceive that Hitler's policy of deliberately risking war with Britain, France, and Russia, against the advice of the top generals, would, if carried out, be the ruin of Germany. Beck had got wind of Hitler's meeting with Keitel on April 21st, in which the Wehrmacht was instructed to hasten plans for attacking Czechoslovakia. And on May 5th, he wrote out the first of a series of memoranda for General von Brauchitsch, the new commander-in-chief of the army, strenuously opposing any such action. They are brilliant papers, blunt as to unpleasant facts, and full of solid reasoning and logic. Although Beck overestimated the strength of will of Britain and France, the political shrewdness of their leaders, and the power of the French army, and in the end proved wrong on the outcome of the Czech problem, his long-range predictions turned out, so far as Germany was concerned, to be deadly accurate. Beck was convinced, he wrote in his May 5th memorandum, that a German attack on Czechoslovakia would provoke a European war in which Britain, France, and Russia would oppose Germany, and in which the United States would be the arsenal of the Western democracies. Germany simply could not win such a war. Its lack of raw materials alone made victory impossible. In fact, he contended, Germany's military-economic situation is worse than it was in 1917-18, when the collapse of the Kaiser's armies began. On May 28th, Beck was among the generals convoked to the Reich Chancellery after the May crisis to hear Hitler storm that he intended to wipe Czechoslovakia off the map the coming autumn. He took careful notes of the Führer's harangue, and 2 days later, on the very day that Hitler was signing the new directive for Green, which fixed the date for the attack as October 1st, penned another and sharper memorandum to Brauchitsch, criticizing Hitler's program point by point. To make sure that his cautious commander-in-chief fully understood it, Beck read it to him personally. At the end, he emphasized to the unhappy and somewhat shallow Brauchitsch that there was a crisis in the top military hierarchy which had already led to anarchy, and that if it was not mastered, the fate of the army, indeed of Germany, would be black. A few days later, on June 3rd, Beck got off another memorandum to Brauchitsch in which he declared that the new directive for Green was militarily unsound, and that the Army General Staff rejected it. Hitler, however, pressed forward with it. The captured Green file discloses how frenzied he grew as the summer proceeded. The usual autumn troop maneuvers, he orders, must be moved forward, so that the army will be in trim for the attack. Special exercises must be held in the taking of fortifications by surprise attack. General Keitel is informed that the Führer repeatedly emphasized the necessity of pressing forward more rapidly the fortification work in the West. On June 9th, Hitler asks for more information on Czech armament and receives immediately a detailed report on every conceivable weapon, large and small, used by the Czechs. On the same day, he asks, "Are the Czech fortifications still occupied in reduced strength?" In his mountain retreat, where he is spending the summer, surrounded by his toadies, his spirits rise and fall as he toys with war. On June 18th, he issues a new general guiding directive to Green. "There is no danger of a preventive war against Germany. I will decide to take action against Czechoslovakia only if I am firmly convinced that France will not march and that therefore England will not intervene." On July 7th, however, Hitler is laying down considerations of what to do if France and Britain intervene. "The prime consideration," he says, "is to hold the western fortifications until Czechoslovakia is smashed and troops can be rushed to the western front. The fact that there are no troops available to hold the western fortifications does not intrude itself upon his feverish thinking. He advises that Russia is most likely to intervene, and by now he is not so sure that Poland may not too. These eventualities must be met, but he does not say how." Apparently, Hitler, somewhat isolated at Obersalzberg, has not yet heard the rumblings of dissent in the upper echelons of the Army General Staff. Despite Beck's pestering of Brauchitsch with his memoranda, the General Staff Chief began to realize by midsummer that his unstable commander-in-chief was not bringing his opinions to the notice of the Führer. By the middle of July, Beck therefore determined to make one last desperate effort to bring matters to a head, one way or the other. On July 16th, he penned his last memorandum to Brauchitsch. He demanded that the army tell Hitler to halt his preparations for war. "In full consciousness of the magnitude of such a step, but also of my responsibilities, I feel it my duty to urgently ask that the Supreme Commander of the Armed Forces, Hitler, call off his preparations for war, and abandon the intention of solving the Czech question by force until the military situation is fundamentally changed. For the present, I consider it hopeless, and this view is shared by all the higher officers of the General Staff. Beck took his memorandum personally to Braukitsch and augmented it orally with further proposals for unified action on the part of the army generals, should Hitler prove recalcitrant. Specifically, he proposed that in that case the ranking generals should all resign at once. And for the first time in the Third Reich, he raised a question which later haunted the Nuremberg trials. Did an officer have a higher allegiance than the one to the Führer? At Nuremberg, dozens of generals excused their war crimes by answering in the negative. They had to obey orders, they said. But Beck on July 16th held a different view, which he was to press, unsuccessfully for the most part, to the end. There were limits, he said, to one's allegiance to the supreme commander, where conscience, knowledge, and responsibility forbade carrying out an order. The generals, he felt, had reached those limits. If Hitler insisted on war, they should resign in a body. In that case, he argued, a war was impossible, since there would be nobody to lead the armies. The chief of the German Army General Staff was now aroused as he had never been before in his lifetime. The scales were falling from his eyes. What was at stake for the German nation, he saw at last, was more than just the thwarting of a hysterical head of state bent out of pique on attacking a small neighboring nation at the risk of a big war. The whole folly of the Third Reich, its tyranny, its terror, its corruption, its contempt for the old Christian virtues, suddenly dawned on this once pro-Nazi general. 3 days later, on July 19th, he went again to Braukitsch to speak of this revelation. Not only, he insisted, must the generals go on strike to prevent Hitler from starting a war, but they must help clean up the Third Reich. The German people and the Führer himself must be freed from the terror of the SS and the Nazi party bosses. A state and society ruled by law must be restored. Beck summed up his reform program. For the Führer, against war, against boss rule, peace with the church, free expression of opinion, an end to the Cheka terror, restoration of justice, reduction of contributions to the party by one half, no more building of palaces, housing for the common people, and more Prussian probity and simplicity. Beck was too naive politically to realize that Hitler, more than any other single man, was responsible for the very conditions in Germany which now revolted him. However, Beck's immediate task was to continue to browbeat the hesitant Braukitsch into presenting an ultimatum on behalf of the army to Hitler, calling on him to stop his preparations for war. To further this purpose, he arranged a secret meeting of the commanding generals for August 4th. He prepared a ringing speech that the army commander-in-chief was to read, rallying the senior generals behind him in a common insistence that there be no Nazi adventures leading to armed conflict. Alas for Beck, Braukitsch lacked the courage to read it. Beck had to be content with reading his own memorandum of July 16th, which left a deep impression on most of the generals. But no decisive action was taken, and the meeting of the top brass of the German army broke up without their having had the courage to call Hitler to count, as their predecessors once had done with the Hohenzollern emperors and the Reich chancellors. Braukitsch did summon up enough courage to show Beck's July 16th memorandum to Hitler. Hitler's response was to call in not the resisting ranking generals, who were behind it, but the officers just below them, the Army and Air Force staff chiefs of various commands, who formed a younger set on which he believed he could count after he had treated it to his persuasive oratory. Summoned to the Berghof on August 10th, Hitler had scarcely budged from his mountain villa all summer. They were treated after dinner to a speech that, according to Jodl, who was present and who described it in his faithful diary, lasted nearly 3 hours. But on this occasion the eloquence of the Führer was not so persuasive as he had hoped. Both Jodl and Manstein, who was also present, later told of a most serious and unpleasant clash between General von Wietersheim and Hitler. Wietersheim was the ranking officer at the gathering, and as designate chief of staff of the Army of the West under General Wilhelm Adam, he dared to speak up about the key problem which Hitler and the OKW were dodging. That with almost all of the military forces committed to the blow against Czechoslovakia, Germany was defenseless in the West and would be overrun by the French. In fact, he reported, the West Wall could not be held for more than 3 weeks. The Führer, Jodl recounted in his diary, becomes furious and flames up, bursting into the remark that in such a case the whole army would not be good for anything. "I say to you, Herr General," Hitler shouted back, "the position will be held not only for 3 weeks, but for 3 years." With what, he did not say. On August 4th, General Adam had reported to the meeting of senior generals that in the West he would have only 5 active divisions and that they would be overwhelmed by the French. Wiedersheim presumably gave the same figure to Hitler, but the Führer would not listen. Jodl, keen staff officer though he was now so much under the spell of the leader that he left the meeting deeply depressed that the generals did not seem to understand Hitler's genius. The cause of this despondent opinion, Wiedersheim's, which unfortunately is held very widely within the Army General Staff, is based on various grounds. First of all, it, the General Staff, is restrained by old memories and feels itself responsible for political decisions instead of obeying and carrying out its military assignments. Admittedly, it does the last with traditional devotion, but the vigor of the soul is lacking because in the end it does not believe in the genius of the Führer. And one does perhaps compare him with Charles XII. And just as certain as water flows downhill, there stems from this defeatism, Miesmacherei, not only an immense political damage, for everyone is talking about the opposition between the opinions of the generals and those of the Führer, but a danger for the morale of the troops. But I have no doubt that the Führer will be able to boost the morale of the people when the right moment comes. Jodl might have added that Hitler would be able, too, to quell revolt among the generals. As Manstein told the tribunal at Nuremberg in 1946, this meeting was the last at which Hitler permitted any questions or discussions from the military. At the Jüterbog military review on August 15th, Hitler reiterated to the generals that he was determined to solve the Czech question by force, and no officer dared, or was permitted, to say a word to oppose him. Beck saw that he was defeated, largely by the spinelessness of his own brother officers, and on August 18th he resigned as chief of the Army General Staff. He tried to induce Brauchitsch to follow suit, but the army commander was now coming under Hitler's hypnotic power, no doubt aided by the Nazi enthusiasms of the woman who was about to become his second wife. General von Brauchitsch received his divorce during the summer, and on September 24th married Frau Charlotte Schmidt. As Hassel said of him, Brauchitsch hitches his collar a notch higher and says, "I am a soldier. It is my duty to obey." Ordinarily, the resignation of a chief of the Army General Staff in the midst of a crisis, and especially of one so highly respected as was General Beck, would have caused a storm in military circles and even given rise to repercussions abroad. But here again Hitler showed his craftiness. Though he accepted Beck's resignation at once, and with great relief, he forbade any mention of it in the press or even in the official government and military gazettes, and ordered the retired general and his fellow officers to keep it to themselves. It would not do to let the British and French governments get wind of dissension at the top of the German army at this critical juncture, and it is possible that Paris and London did not hear of the matter until the end of October, when it was officially announced in Berlin. Had they heard, one could speculate, history might have taken a different turning. The appeasement of the Führer might not have been carried so far. Beck himself, out of a sense of patriotism and loyalty to the army, made no effort to bring the news of his quitting to the public's attention. He was disillusioned, though, that not a single general officer among those who had agreed with him and backed him in his opposition to war felt called upon to follow his example and resign. He did not try to persuade them. He was, as Hassel later said of him, pure Clausewitz without a spark of Blücher or York. A man of principles and thought, but not of action. He felt that Brauchitsch, as commander-in-chief of the army, had let him down at a decisive moment in German history, and this embittered him. Beck's biographer and friend noted years later the general's deep bitterness whenever he spoke of his old commander. On such occasions he would shake with emotion and mutter, "Brauchitsch left me in the lurch." Beck's successor as chief of the Army General Staff, though his appointment was kept a secret by Hitler for several weeks until the end of the crisis, was Franz Halder, 54 years old, who came from an old Bavarian military family and whose father had been a general. Himself trained as an artilleryman, he had served as a young officer on the staff of Crown Prince Ruprecht in the First World War. Though a friend of Röhm in the first post-war Munich days, which might have made him somewhat suspect in Berlin, he had risen rapidly in the army and for the past year had served as Beck's deputy. In fact, Beck recommended him to Brauchitsch as his successor, for he was certain that his deputy shared his views. Halder became the first Bavarian and the first Catholic ever to become chief of the German General Staff, a severe break with the old Protestant-Prussian tradition of the officer corps. A man of wide intellectual interests, with a special bent for mathematics and botany, my own first impression of him was that he looked like a university professor of mathematics or science, and a devout Christian, there was no doubt that he had the mind and the spirit to be a true successor to Beck. The question was whether, like his departed chief, he lacked the knack of taking decisive action at the proper moment, and whether, if he did not lack it, at that moment he had the character to disregard his oath of allegiance to the Führer and move resolutely against him. For Halder, like Beck, though not at first a member of a growing conspiracy against Hitler, knew about it and apparently, again like Beck, was willing to back it. As the new chief of the General Staff, he became the key figure in the first serious plot to overthrow the dictator of the Third Reich.